The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of the Independent Institute.
Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas, brought to you by The Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to many of the issues we face today in America. Today's guest, I'm delighted to say, is H.R. McMaster. H.R. is the Fouad and Michelle Ajami Senior Fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, and also the Bernard and Susan Liatode Fellow at Freeman Spogli Institute, and he also lectures at Stanford's Business School. HR and I have a conversation about several of today's hotspots in the world, including ongoing military battles arising under the Biden administration and how our elected leaders are functioning to keep us safe. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Okay, HR, welcome.
Hey, Scott, great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for fitting us into your busy schedule. I want to jump right in and start talking about your newest book, which is called At War With Ourselves, My Tour of Duty in the Trump White House. Like me, you had a tour of duty in the Trump White House. And there were so many things to talk about, including I think what I'll get to, which is some of the similarities that you and I had in terms of being sort of new to this environment.
Right.
In the sense of, if people remember the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington kind of thing, there was some, I would call us both naive to the workings, and I want to get into that. The first question, though, that I have is about your own personal background, your own personal journey. I mentioned in an intro of you that you went to West Point. What made you embark upon this whole pathway?
Hey, Scott, you just from my earliest memories, I mean, you know, I always wanted to be an officer in the Army. And I think part of that is because both of my parents, you know, served in different ways. My mom was just a fantastic teacher in an underserved community in Philadelphia. And my dad was a veteran of the Korean War, and he remained in the Army Reserves. And he was a first sergeant when I was a little kid in a local infantry unit in the Germantown neighborhood of Philadelphia. He later got a direct commission to captain and then was the company commander of that same company. So I had been exposed to military service. I was interested in military history. As a little kid, I read everything I could, you know, about military history, the Civil War. And, you know, for our summer vacations, we went to, you know, Gettysburg and to Yorktown. And so it's something I always wanted to do, was to be part of a team, lead teams that take on the quality of a family like they do in our military, and just to be part of a mission bigger than ourselves, to defend our nation, to defend freedom. It was the height of the Cold War. And all my experiences really just heightened my desire to serve in the Army. And for example, when I went to be an exchange student for a couple of months in Romania during the height of Ceausescu's rule there, I saw, you know, what it looks like when human freedom is extinguished, and was even more determined to fight and defend freedom along the frontier in Europe.
Yeah. So you were focused on the Army specifically early on.
I was.
Is that true?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, that sort of led you into a real on-the-ground commander for many, many years. You were in the Army for more than 30 years, if I'm correct.
Right.
That's not necessarily true of everyone who is advising in positions like you did in the White House, National Security, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State. And I sort of want to get your take in a general sense on how important is that to have a military background, and particularly a background, where you were actually on the ground?
Yeah, I think if for National Security Advisor, it's important to have some kind of practical experience on policy implementation, whether it's from, you know, from a military perspective or a diplomatic perspective or somebody who understands what it takes to get things done. I think a lot of times in Washington, you have people who pursue policy careers. Well, I think what makes you better at, you know, giving advice in terms of foreign policy or or national security strategy, or developing or drafting policies, is that kind of practical experience. And I had this, you know, great gift that the Army gave me to be able to lead teams abroad in complex situations. And those observations I made about how difficult it is to implement policy, how problem sets that we're dealing with overseas are complex, and you know, the causality of things aren't quite simple, you know, and your interaction with these complex problem sets can often produce outcomes you didn't desire. So all of that experience, I think, helps you do a better job if you get to Washington. And Scott, for you and I both, I think we had that one tour of duty in Washington. I was never even assigned to the Pentagon previously. But I'll tell you, Scott, just one other part of my experience I would just allude to is the ability to go to graduate school and to read, research, think about, and write history, and especially the history of how and why Vietnam became an American war, with an emphasis on Lyndon Johnson's policymaking and decision-making process. So having, you know, criticized that process and then suddenly finding myself responsible, you know, for national security decision-making, I really had the benefit of that academic and research and writing experience as well.
Mm-hmm. And as sort of an offshoot to that, and I wasn't going to go down this path, but I think I should. I've thought and raised the question, because what should be required to be president of the United States? We have specific requirements that are unique. You have to be a certain age, over 35. You have to be a certain type of citizen. And I've always wondered, since this is the commander-in-chief, this is someone who is the sole person, in at least in theory, and frequently is the sole person, in putting our own children in harm's way, potentially life and death situations, fighting. I wasn't in the military. Again, my father was an enlisted Marine back in the days of Pearl Harbor, but I sort of have a feeling that we have lost the idea of what it really means to go to war. I'm asking this as a layman, and I feel like there's a value, a significant value, in having a president have a perspective of what that really means. It's very simple to be sitting at the top, not on the battlefield, in your Oval Office, assigning young people, young Americans, to potentially lose their lives. I sort of wonder why that isn't, or should it be, a requirement to have had maybe 2 years of military service as one of the requirements. Of course, this won't happen because that's such a major change, but I just thought I'd like your opinion on that.
Well, I think military experience does a number of things for you. In the military, whether you're an officer or enlisted, you're given more responsibility at a younger age than almost any other walk of life. So I think that's beneficial to especially our veterans who, you know, actually go on and make fantastic contributions to our society in many different walks of life. I mean, for me, I had a 5-year commitment at West Point, and I thought probably I would get out after 5 years. And that's what I had told my wife. And then when I retired, Katie said to me, "Hey, thanks for the bonus 29 years, you know, in the Army, because I was just having such a great time and so rewarding to serve."
So how important is the perspective, though, for a president?
I think it's important, Scott. You don't necessarily have to be a military officer, but I think you should have studied and thought about military and diplomatic history. That's why I think it's so important that military history and the study of it not just be limited to the military. And really, that discipline has atrophied considerably across academia. And I think what you need to learn from history is what Sir Michael Howard said, is that, you know, when you study history and what he suggested with depth and context, the tidy outlines of history that are often contrived, you know, they melt away, and you realize that you have to consider, you know, changes in the character of war, but also continuities in the nature of war. And you get that by studying war and warfare and with. In depth, you see the complex causality of events. It makes you sensitive to the human and psychological dimension of war. And then, of course, you have to place war in context of your economic strength and capabilities, in context of what you're trying to achieve from a political and diplomatic perspective, in context of the will of your society, you know? And so I think there are so many different facets of military history But I think you can't go wrong with Sir Michael Howard's recommendation to study it in width, depth, and in context. Now, presidents don't have to be experts in all this, but right. I think they have to know enough to ask the right questions and then convene others around their decision-making process who bring kind of an interdisciplinary perspective, you know, a military perspective, but also, you know, obviously an economic, a diplomatic, in your case, a biomedical and health perspective, you know? So mm-hmm. I think having people from different disciplines really helps you understand complex situations better, understand, you know, a broader range of options and make better decisions.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about your recent book. We are going to skip around quite a bit because there's so much in there, and I just got it yesterday and read almost all of it in one night. So I want to start with sort of the broad topic of style versus substance. And the reason I'm bringing it up that way is because we all know that we have elected several presidents in a row to a great extent on the basis of style, in my view. And we've also elected people with big personalities. And I'm talking back the most recently to President Obama, President Trump, then maybe even the reaction after President Trump won was a rejection of that style. I don't know. But there's a style versus substance issue, or what can be called words versus results. We all know President Trump is not a politician. He's a businessman, and I think a lot of people think that's a positive. And what I wanted to specifically drill down on a little bit, because you mentioned things that I clearly saw. You said that President Trump had disdain for superfluous meetings. You use the word he's impatient with protocol. And that is, I think, no surprise to anyone. But I think that part of the style was very impactful on successes in policy. And I'll give you a few of the examples that you cited, and then you could chime in, of course, and then expand that. One was he was very blunt in his questioning, and that surprised other world leaders in their presence. For instance, in the discussion about Syria and the use of poison gas, he questioned just outright, why would they use poison gas? Why would they do that? And this wasn't a private, advisor conversation. It was with other world leaders. Or he would say things like regarding Venezuela. He said, military action's in consideration. Even though then in your next phrase, you say, of course, military action was not in consideration. And so are using the principles of his own business experience, one-on-one discussion, and, you know, all of the times where he said, he would comment on his relationship, quote unquote, because that is the parlance of someone who's in negotiation. And my view was sort of everything was his business skills, if you will. His style was based on his business world. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
No, I think so, Scott. And then also, you know, the president's personality, a lot of people don't see like the part of his personality where he kind of enjoys discussions with people, you know, and he actually can be quite welcoming and a very gracious host to foreign leaders. And his directness, right, the lack of filter that he has, was oftentimes arresting to people who are used to, you know, kind of diplomacy where people make it an art of saying nothing, right? He would get like right to the point in a lot of cases, you know? He right. would say to Poroshenko, you know, the president of Ukraine, he would say, hey, I hear your country's really corrupt. You know, why should we support you if your country's corrupt? I mean, that's actually pretty effective in terms
Absolutely.
Of sending a good message to him about that, you know? Or he would say to King Abdullah, and this is the serious civil war, I don't really got it. Can you explain it to me here, you know? And so, it was just that direct nature. He didn't feel like he had to have all the answers. He liked, he's kind of a, what people call a conversational learner, right? And it's a different kind of style, you know? And he would talk to world leaders a lot, like he would talk to business associates in New York. And he would get off the boat a lot of times. He would say, hey, next time you're in town, you know, come by. Well, you know, and that would throw them off because they think, is this an official invitation to the White House? You know, but I think a lot of that was very effective because, you know, the other leaders weren't used to that. Xi Jinping,
right.
I give examples with, you know, his conversations with Xi Jinping and others. You know, I think that that technique was effective many times. Now, sometimes, he would, he would say things that, you know, cut against his objectives, but it was really because he did let his guard down. Like he wasn't a person that kind of just go through talking points, you know? So,
right.
So, and again, as I write in At War With Ourselves, that was more often than not effective.
You know, I think in the context of these presidents, they all have their personalities. They all have very in their recent history very different personalities, and you've been quoted, I think, to the delight of the media that despises President Trump, that you your discussion of him and the relationship with Russia and Putin. And what you sort of worded as an attraction, if I may paraphrase, to people who are powerful. But I think your context is very different from their quotes. In my view, as a reader, your context was it's repeated behavior of American presidents that they're very confident in their ability to use their personal charms on Vladimir Putin. And you go through, and maybe you could expound on that and how that was done with George W. Bush, Obama, and President Trump, and sort of contrast what they did.
Yeah, Scott, thanks. And actually, I wrote about this pretty extensively in the previous book called Battlegrounds, where in the two chapters on Russia, which are the first two chapters of the book. And really what I do is I kind of lament in that book that, you know, a series of American presidents since Putin came into power in 2000 believed that they could appeal to him, to his better nature, could, through allaying his security concerns, help him realize that his future lies with Europe and not with China and in opposition to Europe and the West. And it didn't work out for anybody, you know, because Putin is a great liar and a great deceiver. And I go through some of my conversations with President Trump about this, but President Trump, you know, fell into that same kind of trap, but that George W. Bush. So when George W. Bush first met with Vladimir Putin let a little crucifix dangle out of his shirt, you know, and knew that President Bush was gonna ask him about it, you know, and so Putin tells him a story about how this cross was his grandmother's, you know, and his grandmother's house burnt down. This was the only thing that survived from the fire, and he's worn it every day ever since then. You know, that's all a lie. It's all fabricated, but it was meant to appeal to a president who Putin knew was a devout Christian. You know, when President Bush comes back, he says, "I saw a man who really cares genuinely about his own people." Right? President Obama, when he pursued the reset strategy, remember, by the time President Obama pursued the reset strategy, Russia had already invaded Georgia. Right? So this was going to reset the relationship. And also Russia was about to invade for the first time Ukraine in 2014. But this was Hillary Clinton actually brought the reset button to Geneva with Lavrov. But it was President Obama who leaned over to Medvedev, who was keeping the seat warm for Putin so he could come back into the presidency. And he said, hey, I'll have more flexibility after the election. And what he meant is he was going to trade off missile defenses for Poland in the hope that, you know, Putin would become, you know, more cooperative because President Obama was allaying his security concerns. And then President Trump, when he came in, of course, he has a lot of confidence in his ability to make big deals, right? And President Trump, and I don't know if he ever talked to you about this, he was very concerned about nuclear weapons. He was very concerned about, you know, the prospect of nuclear war or proliferation. And that's one aspect of the big deal, like, he wanted to get with Putin. And Putin played to that, you know, played to the president's desire for a big deal by, you know, with false promises of, you know, all kinds of changes in his behavior and that sort of thing. And talking about how beleaguered he was, you know, everybody was out to get him, out to get Putin. But, you know, as President Trump was trying to separate the relationship with Putin from some of the key issues, he was also saying to Putin, like, why are you in Syria? How is that in your interest? And he was, you know, and he would raise these tough issues. And Scott, I mean, most people don't know, in the first year of the Trump administration, he imposed more sanctions on Russian individuals and entities than the previous 8 years of the Obama administration. And when I went in and I tell the story in at War With Ourselves, I tell the story of going into the back room in the Oval Office, you know, the dining room there, and talking to the president about his policy, is kind of reviewing the year. It was like a year in review time. It was early December. And I said, hey, you know, you approved providing defensive capabilities to Ukraine in the form of Javelin missiles, but you didn't, you know, sign the memo yet, you know, and what are you thinking about? And then we had a conversation in which I highlighted to President Trump that what provokes Putin is the perception of weakness. And in providing defensive capabilities to Ukraine, that could be an important element to preventing a war, after which he approved the sale and provision of Javelin anti-tank missiles, which turned out to be pretty consequential. And he did this toward the end of 2017. So in the book, I write about Trump's disruptive nature, how more often than not, in my experience with him, that was actually a benefit to the United States. But also, as you know, with President Trump, he can be so disruptive at times that he disrupts himself, you know, and his own agenda. So the story is just kind of, you know, my experience and my perspective on the president, those around him, how we interacted with some very complicated problems, but in general, how despite, you know, being at war with ourselves at times within the White House and the administration, certainly in our society in terms of how partisan our politics has become, we got a lot of good stuff done, Scott, in that
right.
first year.
I mean, this is what I'm wondering about where we are as a country, because, you know, I actually think that results count.
Absolutely.
And style is something for, you know, popular tabloid magazines, and it's interesting, but the reality is the only problem with a problematic style is if it impacts the results negatively.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, yep. I don't care. And so we have a contrast here, and you bring it up in your book. The style of Obama, and I think a lot of people would say that he's sort of a suave talker, very a smooth guy, well received by everybody. And of course, President Trump has a very different personality. But the reality of Obama talking to off mic to Medvedev and his relationship was conciliatory. It was a relationship of weakness that you outline in your book, and the consequent or Obama going to Cuba and doing the wave with our adversary.
Raul
I mean,
Castro.
A communist
yeah,
dictator.
Right, absolutely.
I mean, this is a guy who may be a president who's well liked by all kinds of people. Superficially, but in the end, you know, the results to me are what matter.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you led in with this, you know, talking about how, you know, politics has become so performative rather than formative. And I'm borrowing that from Yuval Levin, who's at the American Enterprise Institute. He writes about, you know, American political institutions and is a great scholar of this, you know, and I think you're right. I mean, we need our political leadership, our political class, to focus on results, you know, and I think that, you know, when you look at the, you know, kind of the nature of these campaigns, a lot of it's form over substance. And I would say certainly you can see that now with Vice President Harris, who did not sit for an interview until recently, and you know, everything was about like the good feeling, you know, coming out of the convention. I would say even President Trump, you know, he sort of tends toward the performative these days. What I would love to see, you know, is a debate about the policies. I would love to see both candidates talking about what would they do to advance American interests. What would they do, you know, to cope with some of these very significant dangers we see in the world today, Scott? You know, these cascading crises. You know, from, you know, the first major war in Europe since World War II. You know, the violence and suffering across the Middle East associated with Iran's support for these terrorists and militias, and you know, how I think they've activated the whole ring of fire around Israel in an effort to destroy Israel and kill all the Jews. I mean, I think that's really what Iran wants and is using these proxy forces to do. And then, you know, China's getting much more aggressive, Scott, you know, in the South China Sea, but also economically. I think China may take actions, you know, to kind of try to crater our economy here in the coming months.
I want to go through some the specific sort of areas talk about, I'll call them hotspots, but they're also very relevant to what happened under President Trump versus under President Obama versus under President Biden. And I think this is very important for people to understand because, again, I would hope, although it's probably not true, but I wish that our country was focused on results and actions rather than style. Let's go through some of these areas because there's so many things going on here. And I'd like you to see what you think about how we handled it under Obama, under Trump, and under Biden. First is the Middle East. Okay, we had what seemed to be decades of this desire from when I was a little kid about a two-state solution. We had many starts and stops over the decades for having a support of Israel, but having them survive. And I think we have a president in your experience, President Trump, who was very specifically active about the Middle East and Israel. I'd like you to hear what you have to say about what President Trump did and how that compared to what happened under Obama and what happened subsequently under Biden.
Well, hey, thanks, Scott. This is a big part of the book, you know, and I read about how when I came into the job unexpectedly, I was really happy to be able to help a disruptive president disrupt some things that need to be disrupted. And in particular, the Obama administration's approach to the Middle East, and especially the conciliatory approach to Iran, which had resulted in the Iran nuclear deal, or the JCPOA, and that Iran nuclear deal was fundamentally flawed for a number of reasons. The deal itself was based on concession after concession that really wound up with a very weak inspection and verification regime, had a sunset clauses that would allow really Iran, because of that poor verification as well, to continue development of nuclear weapons and get to a threshold capability. It didn't include the missiles, you know, that would deliver Iranian nuclear weapons. But also the main flaw was it gave Iran sanctions relief, which filled the coffers of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps and the proxy forces and terrorist organizations that they support across the region, from the Hashd-Shaabi militias in Iraq to the Houthis in Yemen, to, you know, bolstering the Assad regime with a proxy army in Syria. And of course, Hezbollah, Hamas, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And what President Trump did is he completely reversed that strategy. The formal announcement of that strategy was in September of 2017. I would recommend your viewers read that speech he gave on Iran. That's exactly, you know, what the Obama administration should have been doing, but they're doing the opposite. And by the way, it's what the Biden administration put back into place, the Obama administration. So I write in the book in the postscript, that the value of a lot of President Trump's strategies and policies only became apparent to many Americans after the Biden administration reversed them and went back to this policy of conciliation with the Iranians after the Trump administration had dried up the resources available for Iran. And we see what the result is of this conciliatory approach, undesignating the Houthis as a terrorist organization, for example. And then, of course, in the Middle East broadly, associated with the threat from Iran, President Trump restored good relations with many of our Arab Gulf allies, as well as with Israel. These were countries that, because of the policy of accommodation with Iran, that the Obama administration had alienated. You know, and so from the very beginning, President Trump went to the Middle East. Do you remember what people were saying? Hey, what the hell is Donald Trump doing going to Riyadh? You know, his first overseas trip. But I write about this extensively in the book. The title is called Travels with Trump, you know, the first trip overseas. And you know, and he went to the to the capitals or the centers of the three Abrahamic religions, to Saudi Arabia, then to Jerusalem, and then to Rome. And his message was really a profound message, which was one of all being people of the book, to use the Muslim phrase, and the need for all of us to take a very strong stand against these Islamist extremists who are driving the cycle of violence and posing a threat to all civilization. His speech that he made in Riyadh, if you read that, and then King Salman's speech, the King of Saudi Arabia, they totally reinforced each other. And then we said from the beginning, we want to pursue the normalization of relations between Gulf states and Israel. What did people say, Scott, back then? That's crazy. That'll never happen. But but the president and Jared Kushner, who did a fantastic job on this, and Jason Greenblatt, who I think is an American hero, that guy. I mean, he's just a natural diplomat who left it all in the field there in the Middle East
and
generated the Abraham Accords. Yeah. So contrast that with, again, different conditions, especially after the Khashoggi murder by Saudi Arabia. I understand all that, but the Biden administration alienated our Gulf partners again, mainly because they were supplicating to the Iranians again. They stopped reinforcing the sanctions, which resulted in about $80 to $100 billion of additional revenue for Iran, let alone the direct transfers of funds. And another direct transfer of funds, they were getting ready to make another payment to the Iranians just before the October 7th mass murders in Israel. So it's just astounding to me, the fecklessness of the Biden administration's policy and how it cuts directly against American interests and the interests of our allies.
And this is still underplayed, I think, the success of the Trump administration in the Middle East. And I think it points to, frankly, the distortion of American media, sadly, because I think under a different president, this would have been clearly Nobel Peace Prize type things, although I have come to realize these awards are meaningless. But the reality is that was one of the great changes of stabilizing the Middle East. And it was based on, if I can really be succinct, in a business relationship, in understanding that countries want to prosper and prosperous countries are good for their citizens.
Right. And of course, you're still going to have, ideology, and people who don't care about economic progress because, for example, Hamas doesn't give a damn about the Palestinian people, their own people. They deliberately try to get them killed, but they also divert any kind of, economic benefit or any kind of assistance or aid into their terrorist infrastructure, So I think that economics isn't going to solve everything, but people were kind of ridiculing the Trump administration when they came up with that plan for regional economic integration. I think it's still an important contribution, even though it might be shelved for a while right now. But if you want to communicate to the people of the region, hey, if you reject what Iran is doing to keep the cycle of sectarian violence going, if you reject the Islamist terrorist organizations who are trying to foment hatred and use hatred to justify violence against innocents, and we can come to some kind of an enduring agreement for peace, then they could benefit. But, course, there are a lot of obstacles now. It's hard to even think
especially
about.
Especially now. And I think the obstacles were created because of American weakness. Because in the reality, again, in this idea of results versus style, the Middle East was peaceful under President Trump. The Middle East is far from peaceful right now, and it's a complete reversal of that situation, which is, without using hyperbole, certainly has potential to spread to something much, much bigger. I think I'm not telling you something you don't know.
No.
I mean, and you can correct me if I'm wrong in that statement.
Well, I would just say, hey, I wouldn't say the Middle East was peaceful under President Trump, but it wasn't as bad as it is now. I mean, because you still have the Syrians.
Yeah, well, it's all relative.
Yeah, and you still have the Houthis were a problem. But what happened is, with this effort to conciliate with Iran, it emboldened Iran and enriched Iran and allowed them to intensify their proxy wars across the region. I think it's really important, Scott, to realize, to recognize that Iran is willing to expend every Arab life in their effort to push us out of the region so they can isolate Israel, destroy Israel, and kill all the Jews, okay? And, people think, Well, that sounds kind of like Dr. Evil-esque, right? No, that's exactly what they want to do. You just have to listen to them, you know? And so, you know, it's really, I think, important to recognize the nature of the challenges. I do think President Trump got that. You know, I write in the book about how I used to say often, you know, hey, everywhere there's a problem, everywhere I look, there's a rant, you know? He got that and put into place a policy that was aimed at blocking Iran's path to a nuclear weapon, but was also aimed at drying up the resources they have available for their proxy wars against, you know, the great Satan, us, and Israel, who they call the cancerous boil, you know? So, you know, I think we have to listen to these hostile regimes and take them at their word, you know, and respond accordingly.
Thank you for listening to part one of my interview with today's guest, H.R. McMaster. For part two, come back soon.